From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at a Children's Wisconsin program helping kids and families dealing with violence. Then we'll explore a new program at Marquette that'll have Marquette faculty living alongside first and second year students.
National research suggests that those students are the ones who really most benefit from having faculty members nearby to mentor them and help them with some of the challenges that can come up in a college student's life.
Plus, learn about the legend surrounding Friday the 13th and its ominous place in our culture.
Stephen King claims to have this fear of the number 13. And if noted horror master is afraid of this number, perhaps there's credence.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Milwaukee is seeing an increase in deadly violence this year when compared to 2021. And for survivors of violence, both the mental and the physical wounds need to be tended to. Project Ujima is a program through Children's Wisconsin that supports youth victims of violence and their families, providing treatment to recover physically and mentally. Through mentorship and support groups, Project Ujima aims to care for the whole person. Brooke Cheaton is the manager for Project Ujima at Children's Wisconsin. She joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to talk about the program.
Well, Brooke, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. Really excited to chat with you today.
Awesome. I'm so excited to share some more information about Project Ujima with you.
Well, just to start off, tell me about Project Ujima. What does Ujima stand for?
Sure. Project Ujima is a term that stands for collective work and responsibility. So our tagline is working together to make things right. We are a violence intervention and prevention program with Children's Wisconsin.
How did the program get started? Why did it get started?
Sure. Project Ujima started in 1996 as a result of an uptick in community violence throughout the city of Milwaukee. So it began after a young man was treated in the Children's Wisconsin Emergency Department multiple times for a variety of injuries, some accidental, some purposeful at the hands of others or as a result of community violence. And the team at Children's Wisconsin decided they wanted to do something other than just treat his physical injuries. So they wanted to treat the social, the emotional, and just community violence as a whole.
That's really awesome. It's a very holistic approach. Why the focus on both the physical and the mental and the emotional aspects? What kinds of programming does Children's offer through Project Ujima?
So Project Ujima works at treating the whole individual and the whole family. And that's because when something happens to you, something traumatic, like an injury from a violent victimization or community violence, it doesn't just affect you physically. There is mental, emotional damage. You may become nervous going back out to the community. You may not want to talk to your peers. You may start to isolate or withdraw. So the program really focuses on treating the whole individual and their entire household. So when we work with families, we can address a number of different needs, specifically basic needs like housing, food insecurities. But we also focus on additional items like mental behavioral health, and then working on peer supports and social supports as well.
And like you just mentioned, this Project Ujima supports youth who were victims of violence, and they're supported by children through medical treatment and communal support with this program with Project Ujima. And Brooke, what are the young people going through when you first meet them, when they first start at Project Ujima?
So most of our referrals are coming by way of Children's Hospital Emergency Department. And so a number of the kids are coming in with a variety of different injuries from gunshot wounds or stab wounds or from a physical assault. And our staff respond to them on an on-call basis. So when a child comes in, they page us and we respond. First and foremost, our focus is to provide support and advocacy. We listen, we sit, we hear their story. And really want to pay attention to listening to the individual and hearing them. We want to give them an opportunity to share what difficulties they're having and what they need help with. The program really is goal-oriented, so we work on anything that that family or child wants to work on. It's not a program where we tell them what they need to do. It's voluntary. So when they're ready, they tell us and we support them on that journey.
Yeah, and as we've seen throughout the city of Milwaukee, we've seen increases of crime rates happening, especially towards our young people within the city. Has there been an increase in young people and families participating in Project Ujima?
Yes, most definitely, especially since the uptick in the pandemic. So we've seen a number of families referred to the program, but more significantly, a number of individuals suffering from firearm injuries that have been referred to the program. And that includes individuals of all ages as well.
And with experiencing violence and with surviving from violence, there's a lot of emotional support that's needed in the healing process. And what could potentially happen if a young person who has survived a very traumatic event of violence are left without support?
Yeah, so usually when we work with children specifically that are seen for a traumatic injury, the first thing that we see are various levels of PTSD. And sometimes post-traumatic stress shows up at different times. It can show up the same day, it can show up a week later, it can show up years later. And so really what we try to do is educate families on the signs and what to watch for, and then how to support their loved one. When we work with the kids that are coming in, sometimes, you know, they're angry, sometimes they're sad, and sometimes they're withdrawn. It can kind of, the effects of trauma can show themselves in all different ways. And really what we try to focus on as the Project Ujima team is helping them on that journey. So maybe we have to address that anger first and calm the individual and let them know, hey, you didn't do anything wrong here. No one deserves to be a victim. And then from there, we work on empowerment. What can we do to make you feel stronger and more comfortable getting back out there, talking with individuals or peers? What can we do to get you feeling more comfortable going back to school or even to the park across the street? So really working on their confidence and their self-awareness and self-esteem to get them back out there and stronger than ever.
And this program has been around since 1996. That's a pretty long time for a program to be around for that long. And with the families and with the young people that you're able to support through this process, how have the young people and families who have gone through the program responded in the support from Children's Wisconsin?
Sure. We've worked with a variety of different victimizations and a variety of individuals over the last 25 plus years. And the common feedback that we're getting from families and children is that, you know, this is the best program nobody wants to be a part of. You don't want to be a part of a program that treats you for being a victim. But all in all, the strength base shows that they are all survivors. You know, we have a program where it's completely voluntary. We don't charge the families anything to participate in, which takes a little bit of that weight off their shoulders. They know that they can send their child somewhere safe with staff where it's going to help them get stronger and become more empowered. We have a variety of different programming and development opportunities for the youth as well. So we have a summer day camp, we have mentoring life skills programs, and a leadership program too, where we can really help give the kids a voice and allow them an opportunity to just be a kid. If the community knows someone that has suffered as a result of community violence and they are looking for support and help, they can just search Project Ujima within Children's Wisconsin website and get that information. And it also lists our confidential referral email and confidential referral line number, which is 414-266-2557.
Yeah, that's definitely so important to just still be kids through it all. But Brooke, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today.
Sure, thank you. I appreciate you.
Brooke Cheaton is the manager for Project Ujima at Children's Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang about the program. Some students at Marquette University will have some interesting new neighbors this year. They're teachers. Heidi Bostick, the Dean of Arts, Sciences, and Education, and her husband, theology instructor Stephen Pluhacek, are piloting a new faculty-in-residence program. They're living in a nicely renovated apartment at the Marquette-owned Campus Town East, alongside students. The goal is to build relationships between faculty and students and offer them a more informal support system of mentors. Bostic joins WUWM education reporter Emily Files to talk about how it's going.
So the faculty and residence program at Marquette is in its pilot phase this year, with my husband and me serving as the inaugural faculty members in residence. The idea will be to engage faculty members who are interested in really working with students beyond the classroom, to make sure that our intellectual environment on campus is vibrant, to make sure that students have an extra resource beyond the classroom for their development, for questions they may have, for professional discernment, vocational questions, that kind of thing. So the idea will be that faculty will live particularly in residence halls along with our first and second year students. National research suggests that those students are the ones who really most benefit from having faculty members nearby to mentor them and help them with some of the challenges that can come up in a college student's life.
So can you describe the building that you're living in, what your accommodations look like, and what kind of interaction you have with students?
Sure. My husband and I are living in Campus Town East, which is a Marquette-owned apartment building for third and fourth year students and graduate students. And so it's really not your typical housing arrangement for faculty and residents. Most programs focus on first and second year student residence halls, and that will also be the aim long term at Marquette.
Sorry to interrupt. Was that just because there was an apartment available in that residence hall?
Exactly. So this whole idea really came about pretty quickly. Stephen, my husband, and I started talking with Mary Jantz, our really visionary, wonderful colleague in residence life, just in May of this year, and floated an idea about what about piloting a faculty in residence program. And it was pretty amazing. That first conversation, the words left my mouth, and it was like a lightning bolt went through the room, and Mary's eyes lit up, and she said, "Heidi, I've just been dreaming and thinking about this." She said, "We've been wanting to do this. We even had an external review a couple years back that suggested we do this." And she said, "I think I have just the place for you to move into soon if you want to and start piloting this program." So the apartment we're living in is pretty nice. It's a combined two apartments into one. And it was refurbished, actually, for a former president at Marquette who was a Jesuit. And as president, he thought it would be better for him to live separately and not with the Jesuits in the residence. And so that's what the apartment was developed as. And so it's really was designed with the idea of hosting students. So it's got a nice large seating area. It's got a pretty big dining room. It's got space to host students, even potentially cook alongside with students and have meals, have discussion groups, that kind of thing.
How did you and your husband end up being the ones piloting this program?
We've moved around quite a bit. Wisconsin is the 10th state we've lived in, and we've also lived in two other countries. And we've had a lot of different housing arrangements. We've lived in tiny apartments, big houses, and everything in between. We'd been doing a lot of discernment about how to engage more deeply with the Marquette community, and also thinking about some of the needs we have at Marquette, including the need to support students. This is a really particularly challenging time. We all are familiar with the conversations about mental health issues, especially for young people. It's something that Marquette's president, President Mike Lovell, and his wife Amy Lovell care deeply about. And there's a renewed focus on student success at Marquette. So Stephen and I really thought, how might we support our own deeper engagement with the Marquette community and at the same time help to pilot a way that students can receive that extra support from faculty?
So how is it going so far? How is your life looking different than it was before?
We absolutely love it. And, you know, part of it is the kind of marquee events where, for instance, we recently met with some students in a living learning community called Nuestro Hogar, which is for Latinx students on campus. But I think just as important are the kind of everyday interactions, even with the students who work at the front desk in our apartment building. "Hi, how are you? How's it going?" Being at the university just entails a lot of challenges. A lot of our students are working, they're doing undergraduate research, they're really busy, they've got all their classes, they're thinking about their future. And so just having somebody who cares about them, and you know, an older adult who cares about them to check in, I just love that. It's so easy to go to events on campus, whether it's to pop over to a church service or to go to an evening event. We're looking forward to getting theater season tickets, and it'll be so easy to attend events. So really trying to live alongside students and be supportive of them. We really love it. And the inevitable question comes up, well, what about your work-life balance? And I kind of laugh, and Stephen and I both talk about making a distinction between job on the one hand and work on the other. Job being that what you do to pay the bills and so on, and work being more like your vocation, your calling. And so in that sense, I really wouldn't want a separation between my work and my life. I really love that integration that you can have when you're part of that community.
What kinds of interactions have you organized so far with the students, or are you planning to try out in order to kind of build those relationships and make sure that the students know that you're there as a resource for them?
Right. So we have had one organized focus group, a bunch of first-year students from a wonderful colleague's first-year English course, who just came together over some snacks, and we just said to them, you know, what are your interests beyond the classroom? What do you think about a faculty in residence program? And it'll be really important to seek a lot of student input. The whole idea, if we want to serve students, is we need to ask them what their needs are. Our more concrete plans coming up will be to host some dinners. And so one thing we're planning to do is in Straz Tower, one of the larger first year residence halls, there's a big kitchen. And we're hoping to have a community dinner with some students who live in Straz. We are looking forward to an upcoming meeting with the resident assistants, which are upper level students who work in the residence halls, asking them what the best way is to get involved. Is there maybe a floor of a residence hall that we could adopt, or ask them to adopt us? What we've heard so far from students is really interesting. They tend to think about some pretty practical things. For example, could a faculty member in residence help to organize a review session before an exam? That kind of thing. There's also been some interest in Stephen and me doing some workshops around a curriculum we've developed called Designing a Good Life. And it's using design thinking principles to really assist students in their discernment about what they want their future career to look like, what they want their life to look like, what their values are, and how they hope to carry that out in the professional life after they leave Marquette.
So it sounds like since you're in an apartment building that houses upperclassmen, you're kind of going outside of your actual residence to build connections with students, since it's the first year, second year students who are kind of the focus of this type of program?
We're really looking to do both. So we are eager to keep interacting with the students in our apartment building, as well as reaching out to the first and second year students. And so what we're doing as part of this pilot is just exploring different avenues and then trying to maybe make it a little clearer and easier for the folks who will come after us. And as we start building this program out, putting out applications, identifying the spaces on campus that are the most likely place for faculty and residents to live. So it's really a mixture, and we are here to serve all students. We know that students need support each one of their 4 years as they pursue their undergraduate degree. The kinds of support they need, maybe the frequency of support they need, differs. And of course, students who are in their third and fourth year tend to have their networks more well established. They tend to work more closely with the professors in their department, and they tend to have a clearer idea of their path after graduation.
So now that you're kind of walking in the same steps as the students, is there anything that surprised you about the student experience and the dorm life, the dining halls, that kind of thing?
Something we found out, and it's really not a surprise as teachers, is that it's always great when you can have a relatively structured experience. For example, it doesn't work very effectively for faculty members to show up one evening in the dining hall and walk up to a table of students and say, hey, let's join you for dinner. Because, you know, students need their own space too, and they have their own networks, and maybe they were planning to spend that dinner time talking with a few friends about some specific topic. So it works a lot better if you can make it special and say, all right, you want to have dinner with the dean. We're planning to do some of that in our apartment. We're planning, like I mentioned, to host some of those in maybe a big kitchen that some of the residence halls have. We have found the students really open and really curious. And the funny part was during move-in, students assumed that we were somebody's parents, because people our age hanging around the apartments during move-in are, generally speaking, people's parents helping them move in. And we've had to just clarify that, you know, we are here. And in fact, Mary Jan's in residence life has provided us with some nameplates. And so outside of our apartment, we have nameplates saying Heidi Bostic and Stephen Pluhacek, faculty in residence, just to help make our presence more visible. We've also been talking about at midterm and finals, providing support to students who get together for study groups. For example, the Honors Program Living Learning Community has a tradition of getting together at midterm and finals to study together. And that director, Amelia Zerker, has suggested it might work for us to come and interact with students, provide them some words of encouragement, provide them with some snacks. And, you know, I really think that it's like with any of us, you really love it, you value it when somebody evinces caring about you. You know, how are you doing? How might I support you? How's it going as you prepare for your exams?
So what are the plans for the future of the program?
Well, the future of the program, what we're hoping for is this, again, to continue eliciting a lot of student input about what they need and want in a faculty in residence program. There are some other examples out there and a lot of good research about faculty in residence programs, about how interaction with faculty beyond the classroom really supports student success. So continuing to seek those best practices and take our cue from other robust programs elsewhere. We're hopeful to put out a call for applications, and the ideal would be to get additional faculty and residents in place for fall 2023. Stephen and I hope that we'll do this for a while so that we can accompany others who come along as faculty and residents, walk along with them and build a community. And, you know, whoever wants to come into this program in the near term is going to be a kind of pilgrim or a kind of pioneer really creating the program. So we'll be looking for faculty who are really committed to Marquette's mission, really committed to students, and really willing to deal effectively with a bit of ambiguity about what the program is. So the kind of faculty who are innovative and want to help shape what the program will be.
That was Heidi Bostic, Dean of the Klinger College of Arts and Sciences and College of Education at Marquette University. She's piloting a new faculty in residence program this year, and she spoke with education reporter Emily Files. Wisconsin's pastoral landscape is now home to dozens of fine art installations in an exhibition that spans 50 miles of Sauk County farmland. We'll learn all about it in about 10 minutes. But first, we'll explore the Milwaukee Jazz Institute, which hopes to nurture jazz artists at all points in their career. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Charlie Parker, John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk. All jazz greats had to start somewhere. Since 2020, the Milwaukee Jazz Institute has been offering programs to students of all ages who want to get great. WUWM's Mayon Silver went to the Institute's home base to sit down with founder and artistic director, jazz pianist Mark Davis, and talk with him about its mission. Throughout the interview, you'll hear the jazz track Blues for George, which was composed by Davis and is performed by We Six.
So where are we right now?
We right now are sitting in the Jazz Gallery Center for the Arts in River West of Milwaukee. The Jazz Gallery actually has an incredible history. This was a very dynamic jazz club in the late 70s, early 80s, and a lot of the great jazz musicians played here. It was known as the Jazz Gallery, and at that time, Dexter Gordon and Sarah Vaughan and Chet Baker and Art Blakey, Wynton Marsalis, and so many musicians came through and played in this space. But it's lived on, and it's now a community arts space that features local artists in a gallery setting. And we partner with the Jazz Gallery, the Milwaukee Jazz Institute partners with them, and we make use of this space. It's a beautiful place to rehearse and perform. There's a Yamaha grand piano and drum set and PA and a little stage. And so we hold our ensembles here. We have in-person ensembles. We have 8 of them, 4 youth ensembles and 4 adult ensembles that meet weekly and are taught by some of our MJI faculty.
Nice. So how did Milwaukee Jazz Institute come about?
So So, and I sometimes we refer to it as MJI. MJI got started, well, in a way, it got started many decades ago because all the faculty members and the people involved have been involved with this music for a long time, both performing and educating. But we got started in late 2019, November of 2019. We actually formed the organization and then got our nonprofit status, our 501c3, in February 2020, just in time for the pandemic.
So, man, that's insane.
Yeah, so we're just coming up on being 3 years old. But like I say, we've been at this for a long time, but we're very excited about the direction of MJI. It just continues to grow and evolve as the world has changed. We've been evolving, and currently things are just really on the up and up for us.
So you've got students coming in to the jazz gallery to play on this cool checkerboard floored, performance space. How did you adapt during the pandemic? I mean, people are starting to get together more in person now, but what was it like for these past 3 years trying to teach jazz to people?
The mission of MJI is to promote jazz through performance and through education. And we were, when we first got started in 2019 and early 2020, we were teaching in person. When the pandemic hit, we, like a lot of organizations and schools and whatnot, we went online. And we started doing just a whole lot of online workshops on all kinds of different topics that relate to jazz music. And some were on the history of the music, on listening, on technique. And some of those workshops were workshops that people could sign up for and pay for. And we started attracting people, not only from Milwaukee, but we suddenly found we were getting people from all over the country and then all over the world. So it was actually quite exciting for us, just getting started with the organization to realize that we had the potential to have an impact quite broadly, even beyond the city of Milwaukee.
What are some basics about jazz that you start teaching people? I mean, is everybody who comes into the ensemble, do they have a certain level of experience, or can you be a beginner? And how do you even start getting into jazz?
We currently have 8 ensembles that meet weekly in person. And one of the ensembles is rather young. We have middle school students, we have high school students, and then we have adult students. So we really run the whole range of ages and also just backgrounds of people and where they come from and all that kind of stuff. And so as far as how people get started, one of the things we're doing is we've started something called the Jazz Circle, which is whenever you see something that MJI offers that says the Jazz Circle, that means it's free and open to the public. Some of those things are online. Paul Silberglight, one of our faculty members, who's an incredible jazz guitarist, has done a number of great presentations on the history of jazz or on different artists. And so we're putting that out. Those have been online. We're putting it out there and attracting people that want to learn more about what should you listen for when you hear this music. And how can you learn more about the music, and how can you learn more about what these artists are doing when they improvise? We're also offering classes on jazz theory. So we've moved to doing some online courses. So people who are interested in understanding how this music is put together can enroll in an online course. And most of our courses are about 8 weeks long, and they just meet for an hour a week. And it gives them some background of understanding this music and how it's put together.
That's really cool. So let's say you're talking to somebody who doesn't play or even listen to jazz, and or maybe even one step further, they've said something like, I try to listen to jazz and I just don't understand it. What's the way in for people to try to appreciate this genre of music?
There's probably a number of different ways to go about doing that. One of the things that we have is a monthly jam session, and it takes place here at the Jazz Gallery. It's on the second Monday of the month at 8:30 p.m. And a lot of times when people approach me and they're wondering about getting involved with jazz or wondering about getting involved with MJI, I tell them, hey, come to the jam session, and it's free, it's open to the public, and it'll give you a chance to hear musicians of all different levels, all different ages, all different backgrounds, and hear what they're doing. You'll start learning the repertoire that they play. Start learning certain tunes that we call jazz standards, meaning tunes that are frequently played by jazz musicians. So once you start getting familiar with the songs or the tunes that are played, that's certainly a way in to start understanding more about what happens when someone improvises. And these jam sessions are really fun. I would encourage anyone to come out and check them out, because we have people that just come to listen, but we have lots and lots of people that come to play, and it's improvisatory. We just create different combinations of musicians, and they get up on the stage here and we'll call a tune that everyone knows, and off they go. And it might be a professional musician who's been playing for decades alongside a high school kid who's just getting started and figuring this music out. And that's one of the ways people learn about it.
Nice. If people want to take private lessons,
yes.
You know, are you doing that in person or virtually, or how is that connected to MJI, or how does
question.
That work?
Yeah, good question. We currently have 14 faculty members, and I don't feel bad about bragging about them, because they're some of the finest jazz musicians in the area. Some of them live in Chicago, but most live in the Milwaukee area, and they're all available for private lessons, either virtually, meaning online, or in person. And we at MJI try and connect our faculty with students that are either in our ensemble programs or who contact us. We don't get involved directly with setting up the private lessons. We allow the instructors to arrange that individually with the students. But we really encourage it, because it's one of the great ways to learn this music.
That's awesome. And why is jazz education important? This is a big question, you know, but why is jazz education important in society, like for people of all ages?
You know, that's a great question. You know, this music, you know, when we say jazz, it means different things to different people. And, you know, everybody that's involved with it maybe has a particular concept of what the music means. But part of the reason why I think it's so diverse is because, you know, different walks of life, different cultures have their take on it, whether it's Latin jazz or more of a contemporary funk kind of sound, or maybe it's more of a straight-ahead bebop sound. There's a lot of different approaches to it. So in terms of talking about why is jazz important, we could talk musically why it's important. One of the reasons musically is because if you study this music, you will gain an understanding of music in general. Because in order to play jazz, you have to understand not only how to play music, but what to play. And because we're improvising, it's not simply reading notes on the page. It's having to understand the theory and what's involved to create the music. So, you know, even with my piano students, I find once they start studying jazz, they have a whole new outlook on music. If they're a classical pianist, they'll start analyzing the Chopin that they're playing, and they'll start realizing what the chords are and what the progressions are. So it also provides a great basis for people who want to go into more contemporary or other kinds of styles of music. It's really the basis for harmonically and rhythmically and melodically for a lot of styles of music. So studying jazz not only prepares you to be a jazz musician, but prepares you to play many styles of music. In a broader sense, though, I think, you know, this music, and I was talking about our jam sessions as an example, it's a music that brings people together from all walks of life. And it's something that we don't necessarily see in either certain styles of music or even just other activities. But this music, for, you know, because of the origins of it in Black American music and how it has become it's really the fabric of not only American music, but just it permeates so much culture. It's a cultural art form, and I find that it brings people together of all walks of life and all ages and all backgrounds.
How would people get more information about MJI?
You know, we have things that pop up all the time, and so I always encourage people to subscribe to our website, MilwaukeeJazzInstitute.org. And we send out periodic updates about once a week. that will let you know about performances that we're doing. We bring in world-famous jazz artists. We just brought in Benny Banach, a great trumpeter and singer. Brian Lynch, we've brought in several times. Camille Thurman. We've been doing performances with our faculty at different venues. And then we have all kinds of interesting educational things that pop up all the time. So if people subscribe to the website or follow us on Instagram or Facebook, it's a great way to keep up with what we're doing.
Nice. Mark Davis, jazz pianist extraordinaire, thank you so much for coming on Lake Effect.
Mayan, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
That was Mark Davis, jazz pianist and artistic director of the Milwaukee Jazz Institute, speaking with WUWM's Mayan Silver. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll be joined by the Worm Farm Institute. And no, we won't be learning about soil. We're exploring dozens of art installations dotting a 50-mile route through Sauk County farm fields. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every 2 years, a small Wisconsin nonprofit offers a unique opportunity. The Worm Farm Institute selects a handful of artists who create installations that can be viewed along a 50-mile route through Sauk County farm fields. It's called Farm Art Detour. The self-guided event is underway right now. Performances, including dance and music, are sprinkled throughout the 10-day event. Worm Farm Institute Program Director Philip Matthews heads the team that put on this year's tour. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz met Matthews at a gathering of farmers and artists in Milwaukee.
I've been full-time with Worm Farm since spring of 2020, but I actually met the founders, Donna Newirth and Jay Salinas, in the summer of 2015. I was a resident poet on their CSA farm.
So tell me about the place, about the programs.
So Worm Farm Institute is a small nonprofit. We're based in Reedsburg, Wisconsin, but we work all over Sauk County, Wisconsin, which is a rural county. And we also, through the Rural Urban Flow Network, work across the rural urban continuum of Southwest Wisconsin and further afield. Our programs basically occur at the intersection of culture and agriculture. We often work with farmers, artists, conservationists, biologists, writers, etc., to really look at the ways in which the land supports all of us. And even if you feel that you don't necessarily have a connection to farming and agriculture, if you eat, of course you do. And so we use the power of the arts to bring people together around issues that concern the land and the health of the region, which affects the health of all of us.
I mean, it's a daunting task, but it's a big job.
But it's also a fun one. Because the art sparked people's emotional lives, it sparked people's imagination. It's an entry point. So our biggest event is called the Farm Art Detour. It's a 50-mile self-guided circuit through Sauk County's working farmlands. It occurs every other year. And the route is punctuated by large-scale artworks that draw attention to the farmland. So what people are initially coming for may be the artwork, but once they're there, they eventually discover sort of the magic of what farmers do all the time.
How do those art installations come to be? I mean, how are people selected? And
So the artworks are selected by a jury of art professionals. So we just actually finished the open call for this year. We got 109 applications, which is huge. And the jury meets to select the finalists. So finalists, about 15 to 18 are selected, and they come to Sauk County for a tour of the route. So they get to meet participating landowners, former artists, each other, share their ideas. And from there, they go back and they receive a stipend to submit a second round proposal that is then more site responsive because they've actually been in the space and met the people who call the space home. And from there, about 8 artists are selected. to appear on the Detour, which is October 1 through 10, 2022 this year.
And are these all Wisconsin-based artists or not necessarily?
Not at all. In fact, we got a record number of international artists applications this year, but they come from all over the world. Certainly from Wisconsin and the Midwest, yes, but also from both coasts, as well as, again, international applications.
And then tell me again what your role is within the organization. What is the work that you do?
So I am the director of programs. So the way that I like to think about it is that I take the vision of the founders and put the systems in place to make it work. So I help figure out how to get the team from A to B to Z. So I manage a small team of, luckily this year, returning staff members.
Then you do poetry on the side?
Yes. So I am a poet. I went to Washington University in St. Louis from 2009 to 2011 to get my MFA in poetry. And I celebrated the publication of two books, one in fall of 2019 and one in the spring of 2020.
So what has this work brought to you?
You know, I feel really grateful to be in a job where I get to say, I don't know about that, tell me more. Particularly when it comes to the participating landowners and the farmers on the Detour route. I, like many people, have felt disconnected from the source of my food. And so it's a real thrill to learn more about the contemporary state of agriculture.
What kind of farming is going on in Sauk County, and what is the relationship that's been forged? I mean, is it in my brain, I'm thinking, well, it's probably organic farmers who have small operations who gravitate to the work that you're doing. Is that wrong?
It is wrong, actually. I mean, part of the beauty of the Detour is that we welcome both rural residents and urban visitors to this 50-mile route. And in those 50 miles, they experience a whole range of farming practices, everything from, yes, organic and regenerative practices, but also to conventional farming as well. And our job, we don't feel, is to pass a judgment on any of it, but just to say, this is what the reality is in this rural county. What do you make of that? And to really bring people together into these conversations, as opposed to advocating that one kind of practice is better than another.
So what pulled you, I asked what it's brought to you, but what pulled you into it originally? What did you think about what you were stepping into?
Well, like I said, in summer of 2015, I was a resident poet. So Worm Farm's foundational program is an artist residency program where 3 to 4 artists at a time come and basically exchange work in the vegetable CSA garden for room and board, food, and studio space. So when I came to Worm Farm, I was basically taking a 6-week sabbatical from my 9-to-5 job at an art museum in St. Louis, and I loved that job, don't get me wrong. But in that job, I was finding that the way that I considered time was basically in the default hour-long slot of a Google Calendar meeting. So I applied to Worm Farm because I wanted to experience time differently. I wanted to go back to circadian and seasonal rhythm. And it changed the way that I was writing, and it changed the way that I was thinking about my work as a creative. So that's what really drew me in. And then I continued to have friendship and work in sort of remote part-time ways with the organization after that. So when the job came up as a full-time director of programs, I jumped at it.
So walking, what is one experience when you visit, when you're there on site? What is it, what do you...
At the Detour or at the farm?
At the farm.
So when an artist comes to the farm, the thing that really stands out in my memory of my 6 weeks there was the camaraderie among the other artists. You know, it's not required that you begin to, for example, cook together and have group meals and that kind of thing. It just kind of happens organically. So you're in the garden 5 days a week for 3 hours in the morning, and you're helping to plant the crops and weed and harvest the crops for the CSA. And then the rest of the day is yours to really be in your studio, to walk around, experience the landscape, do whatever you want. And I was really lucky to be there with a sculptural artist and 2 other writers at the time, and the friendship just ran really deep in that 6-week period. And so the group meals that we had together, you know, conversations about what are you applying to next, which residencies are you applying to next, what are you looking at, what are you reading, what are you thinking about, having studio visits with each other. It was just really powerful, transformative time.
So that residency program continues. That's an ongoing part of what...
Yes, it's the foundational program. So Worm Farm started as a nonprofit in 2000 with that residency program, and it continues to this day.
Philip Matthews is the program director for Worm Farm Institute. He spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. The Farm Art Detour runs through October 10th. It's the start of a haunting season, and as many of us are getting ready to celebrate Halloween, we're looking at another haunting day, Friday the 13th. It's a day of bad luck, for some a day of terror or taboo. But what makes Friday the 13th such a foreboding date? Anna Larnoy is an expert in all things ghostly or sinister, and she joined me earlier this year to talk about the dreaded day. Anna, thank you so much for joining us here.
I am thrilled to be here on one of the spookiest days of the year, or at least in anticipation of it.
In anticipation, certainly. So what is the history behind specifically the number 13? Because it seems like that's where a lot of this starts.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a word for the fear of the number 13. It's triskaidekaphobia. And studies say 10% of Americans are fearful of the number 13. And 8% are fearful of Friday the 13th, which we are having this week. So this goes back to, many people say, before biblical times. We see the Code of Harambe. It is an ancient list of laws from 1754 BC. And in that list of 282 laws of the land, they've omitted the number 13. So this fear of that number goes back all that way. And some people think it could be even biblically related. If we look at the Last Supper, we see that there were 13 guests, and that 13th guest, Judas, was the person who led to that being the Last Supper. And that's not the only story that has 13 guests. We have a piece of Norse mythology where Odin is having a dinner party, and it is disrupted by his 13th guest, Loki. So that appears in a lot of different cultures. 13 seems to be woven through many of our Western traditions as just being unlucky.
It seems like, as I was looking into this, part of it appears to be that 12 is a very complete number. There are a number of things that have 12, like the 12 tribes of Israel, for mm-hmm. example. But a lot of cultures use 12 as this kind of complete whole number. And then 13 ends up being kind of a bad omen of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
When we come to Friday, especially, is that a biblical link? Is that why Friday is
well,
no good?
we do have some biblical connections for Friday being no good. We have the Good Friday is celebrating the death of, well, actually the resurrection, but you—
Crucifixion,
right. And then we have Adam and Eve being ejected from the Garden of Eden on Friday. As a person who writes a lot about shipwrecks, I noticed that mariners also have a deep fear of Fridays and, in fact, often will avoid scheduling journeys that begin on Fridays. It's supposed to be a bad omen for the entire journey. So they may even leave at, let's say, 11:57 p.m. rather than waiting until after midnight on a Friday to begin their journey because they do not want to mess with the superstitions.
Are there any concrete examples of Friday the 13th actually being unlucky?
Well, we might remember where we all were on March 13th, 2020, because that is the day that lockdown began. And so that was a Friday the 13th. And we could argue that that was, you know, a very unlucky day for all of us. There are, I think, more cultural reminders that 13th is unlucky. We've got the 1980s slasher series of films, Friday the 13th. We have hotels and other large buildings feeding into this by avoiding having a 13th floor. So I think it's so embedded in culture, it would be difficult to say which came first, the unluckiness of the number or that we give reverence to the bad luck.
Well, that gets to my final question, really. How do we see this living on today? Do we see the fear of the 13 in not having a 13th floor, in avoiding 13s of any kind?
I think it's so embedded in our culture, we probably won't get away from it. I kind of like to think about how maybe the spookiest of all Americans that are living today, Stephen King, claims to have this fear of the number 13. And if noted horror master, who can create some of the worst things that we can imagine, is afraid of this number, perhaps there's credence.
Anna Larnoy is the founder of Gothic Milwaukee and author of several books about ghost stories in the city. I spoke with her earlier this year, and you can find more of our conversations with Larnoy at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll be joined by former U.S. Senator Russ Feingold. He'll talk with us about the push to have a constitutional convention and how it could reshape the very fabric of our nation. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.